Hello, welcome to Converging Dialogues. This is Xavier Bonilla. On this episode, I am very thrilled to bring the conversation I had with Stephanie Ternullo. Stephanie is assistant professor in government at Harvard University. She has her PhD in sociology from the University of Chicago. And her research uses multiple methods to explore a bidirectional relationship between place and politics, both in how politics shape places, but also how places shape political identity and behavior. She is the author of the new and fabulous book, How the Heartland Went Red, Why Local Forces Matter in an Age of Nationalized Politics. And that is the book we discuss in the conversation. We start by talking about the shift in certain districts and certain areas in the United States that have gone from liberal to conservative, how they maybe some places have stayed liberal, but what that looks like, and some that are kind of in between, all throughout the 20th and into the 21st century. We talk about her study that she conducted over a few years, how she conducted it. We kind of get into some of the weeds of kind of the construction of the study and, you know, some of her methods and how she interviewed and all these things. But I found it very constructive because in many ways, anytime I listen to conversations or read other papers, people just kind of skim over that. And granted, I mean, some of the designing a study is not exhilarating for conversation. But I think it's actually really important because in a time where people are just kind of citing things and they're not kind of backing things up and they're just kind of leaning on things, but people don't kind of follow up with that, I think that's super important. And I wanted to take the time to really ask how she did this, especially for things that are, you know, very important, and you're making, you know, statements about, you know, groups and places and how they have political impact. So she was very kind to kind of, you know, walk through how she conducted the study, how she did things. Sort of, we don't get too heavy into stats, but we do kind of explain kind of the construction of the study and what went on. I was very, very happy with it. Listening back, it felt very conversational still. So hopefully that comes through. We talk about the makeup of the three Midwest cities used in the study. We talk about the New Deal coalition, why that's the kind of, you know, origins or starting point and what that looks like and how that kind of evolved. We talk about place-based partisanship. It's kind of the central theme of the book, the role of unions, and many more topics. As I already referenced, I really kind of, you know, really got excited talking about how the study was constructed and everything, but really it's the implication, right? It's how this is important for understanding groups of people, how this is understanding political forces, how things are, what are really, really instrumental, how place is really essential. And Stephanie is quite lovely. Super, super bright. She's doing great work, and she really is got, I think, her finger on the pulse here of many of the political issues in different parts of the country. So she's just absolutely fantastic, and so highly recommend her book. As always, you can find this conversation and all other conversations at convergingdialogues@substack.com. I'm also on YouTube, so like, subscribe, follow, share with your friends, contribute. All that's appreciated. And now I bring you Stephanie Ternullo. I am here with Stephanie Ternullo. Stephanie, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I'm very happy to talk to you.
I'm very happy to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Yes, you have written a really, 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 really awesome book. I really enjoyed it. I want to spend some time talking about this. How you came about getting the information. I thought the process was really, really interesting. I'm one of those weirdos that reads the appendices at the back. And so I mm-hmm. was able to look at that and see how you did it. So we can talk about that maybe to start and then, you know, get into all the details. But the book is called How the Heartland Went Red, Why Local Forces Matter in an Age of Nationalized Politics. This is out through the lovely Princeton University Press. That's a great subtitle. I like books a lot, often have subtitles, and sometimes they're good, sometimes they're not. And that's a fantastic one. So we're going to talk all about it. It's an evergreen topic in an election year. Can you first tell listeners who you are, professionally, academically, what you currently think about or what you're currently up to, and any other relevant details?
Yeah. Well, first, I can't take credit for the title. That was my two lovely editors at Princeton. Yeah. Credit where credit is due. They're very good at naming things. My title idea was worse, and they shepherded me in the right direction. So I'm an assistant professor of government at Harvard. So that's our political science department. Mm-hmm. My PhD is actually in sociology. So I kind of have swapped social science disciplines, which doesn't sound big from the outside, but it feels big as a career move. So I've been there a little over a year and a half. In general, my research examines the relationship between sort of local contexts and American political behavior. And I use multiple methods to explore this relationship. Primarily, as you saw in this book, I use in-depth interviews. And I often use sort of repeated interviews with the same people over periods of time around elections to understand how they're thinking about politics in real time as it's unfolding on the ground. And so in my first book, which we'll spend most of today talking about, the book is about how place sort of intersects with race, class, and religion in shaping the rightward turn across the industrial heartland in the US. And hopefully it is a useful topic. And you called it evergreen. I like that. I'm going to steal that from you. I think the more time I spent thinking about the book, I think it's a question that we as social scientists and we as a country have been thinking about for a really long time, decades, because it's a region, it's a kind of place, industrialized cities that are located in a region, largely the Midwest, that is really politically important. And it's been changing for several decades. And so it's been a really politically important question for a long time. And so I loved working on it. My new research is, I like to think of it as the same, but the opposite. So I'm still interested in the relationship between local context and political behavior. And now I'm studying coastal suburbs. So suburbs in California and Massachusetts. And I'm interested in how local contexts are shaping suburbanites' engagement in local politics rather than national politics.
You already have the sequel in the works is what you're telling me. That's what it is.
Apparently what I've learned is that you just have to keep going. Mm-hmm, you just have to keep pitching.
And depending on how long it takes and how fast you write, you might be in time for 2026 midterms or for the next presidential election.
That is so much pressure.
Maybe 28. I have to imagine that going from going into, you said it was governance, right, at Harvard? It sounds like a lot of the stuff in the book, it just sounds like you're kind of, you know, really flexing your sociological muscles in the book, right? It's a lot of, you know, kind of qualitative stuff, some of quasi-ethnographic, kind of some of these things. So even though maybe you're, you know, in the world, you talk about that switch to government, there's a kind of sociological kind of heavy hand on it, which is great. It's a great thing, but you can definitely feel the training and education you have that comes out there. So,
Thanks. I take that as a compliment.
Of course. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of sociologists out there, and then there's few good ones. So it's nice to see when somebody is a good sociologist.
I love so many of them and so much of their work that we'll have to write out this list of the good ones later and compare.
I'm only teasing. I do have a few sociology friends, and they're all wonderful.
So
we're going to start here with some of how you came across with this. So I guess just to kind of jumpstart this, you know, we'll talk about the three cities you kind of use and why and how they're sort of kind of microcosm of other analogous cities, maybe in the so-called heartland. But I want to try and understand, what the approach was with, in trying to understand, you put the centrality of place. You also talk about the intersections of, you know, people, religion, et cetera. So why in the first place did you want to look to the heartland to ask this particular question? You could have asked this question in different ways, but this idea of, well, now there are some places in the Midwest or in the central part of the United States that have become red or trend more conservative, or they vote Republican, or however you want to describe this. And they didn't used to be that way. At least they didn't used to be, you know, maybe 180, 100 years ago. So why did you frame the question that way? Why did you want to look at it that way, of this kind of transformative or transitional kind of way of going from blue to red, or, you know, more liberal to conservative?
Yeah. So I think the best answer to your question is that I didn't start out having any interest in place. It's now the thing that I do all day, every day. It's not the thing that brought me to graduate school. It's not the thing that brought me to this dissertation. The thing that brought me to this project was that I was interested in white working class and working in middle class politics. And I was interested in understanding variation within that group. And I was particularly interested in understanding contemporary variation within that group as a legacy of the breakdown of the New Deal coalition. So there's a lot of research and a lot of sort of, I would say, political rhetoric that kind of talks about working class politics or white working class politics, the Trump coalition, however you want to think about like this group of people who are really electorally central, often because of where they're located, but we think and talk about them a lot. The explicit reference point is the New Deal coalition. So that was like the implicit reference point. So the implicit reference point was the New Deal coalition, which is when the U.S. kind of came the closest that it sort of ever has to having this kind of traditional class politics, as some scholars have called it, where sort of the working classes are associated with the left, in this case, the Democratic Party, and middle and upper classes with the right, in this case, the Republican Party. That was sort of always racialized in the U.S. context at that time. Of course, many Black voters were disenfranchised, but that was sort of like the closest we've ever come to having that traditional class politics, right? And so when we talk today about kind of what's going on with class politics, why doesn't it look a particular way? Why does it look this way? That's the reference point, always implicitly. It's like one time we had that. Sometimes it's a comparative reference point, like why aren't we, you know, Sweden or whatever, but there's a reference point in mind. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the question isn't interesting. So my reference point in this project was the New Deal. And I wanted to understand this kind of contemporary variation within the white working classes as it was rooted in that historical breakdown over, you know, 80 years. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, there's no way to really... Well, I suppose there is a way actually now. I didn't know about it in graduate school. We have voter file lists actually, but it's harder to identify individuals who are similar kinds of people but vote differently. It's a lot easier to identify similar places that vote differently. Mm. So that was the approach I took. I decided to identify white working class places that vote differently. And I went to those places to find individuals who were different. Mm. And then I came up with an answer that explained the variation. I mean, it was place was the answer, right? And so it was just, it came out of the research process, but it was so interesting that now I'll spend my life working on it, I guess.
Well, yeah, the centrality of place is interesting. So it sounds like you kind of stumbled into that. I guess what makes individuals generally, I guess, or more specifically in these dynamics, difficult to study? Is there too much shift, or is it too transient, whereas place is a little bit more stable? What is it that makes individuals a little bit more difficult as place is a little bit relatively more easier to kind of study?
Just in the sense of finding people, right? Mm. So we have surveys, but the surveys are anonymous. So I can see within a survey, what are the predictors of variation within the white working classes? But I wanted to come up with a novel answer, something that wasn't in the survey data. So I wanted to interview, sort of a large group of white working and middle class folks who had different politics and try to understand, you know, the historical roots of those differences. And I thought, I'll go to places that are similar kind of white working class communities and that have different politics, and we'll see what this individual level story is by looking at these different communities. And it turned out to not really be an individual level story at all, which makes sense because, you know, we have a lot of individual level variables on the surveys. So I wanted to go off the surveys and come up with something new. And that's where I landed.
So how did you get to the three cities? And the three cities are Motorville, Lutherton, and Gravesend. Is that how you say it? And
yes, they're all pseudonyms. Just to
Okay. But if I have this correctly, Motorville is more democratically leaning. Lutherton is more Republican leaning, and Gravesend is, if you want, independent. But you know, there's kind of a mix of both. So we can talk about that in a minute. But how did you get to these three cities? And how did they, how did you feel they were a good representative sample that you were looking for your, for your study?
Oh my gosh, this is a great question. I could talk about sampling for qualitative research designs all day. I think about it all day. I talk to graduate students about it all day.
That's great.
I get to teach a class with one of my amazing colleagues on this, for this and other things next year. So this is great. So, okay. I started off with all the counties in the US, and then I wanted to identify something like, you know, the white working class New Deal coalition, that historical reference point that I just described. So, I sort of took all the measures of, occupation, race, income and education. And I chose counties that were sort of, above average in what other scholars have referred to as working class occupations and, sort of over 90% white, both in the 1940s and by 2016. That was the most recent election year when I was doing these data. So these are places that kind of have been white working class counties for 76 years, according to these data, right? So I held demographic composition constant. And then I narrowed it further to only those counties that had voted on average for FDR in the 30s and 40s. So that gave me, I think, 467 counties total. And so that was sort of my white working class New Deal coalition, where they're going to now take different political trajectories from the New Deal. Because as I said, that coalition broke down, but it's going to, that breakdown isn't going to be explained by demographic change, right? Because they still look white and working class today. They looked white and working class then. So they're kind of still similar places, but their politics have changed. Then I took their, presidential vote share from 1964 to 2016. And I used a hierarchical clustering algorithm, which sort of creates clusters based on, it minimizes the variance within clusters. So you can see different trajectories of, I think of that as different political trajectories. So the data I used was voting over 50 years. And so you can see the different, clusters of voting trends from 1964 within that group.
Is this, and it's just, sorry, is this just presidential elections or is this also midterm and local elections as well?
Just presidential.
Okay.
Yeah. So just presidential vote share. So yeah, so you can see, and we have sort of, we already have a big literature that tells us what happened to the New Deal coalition. Like, this is not a novel question in any way. And that literature would say there was, there have been, I'm just going to summarize it, how I think about it in the book and how I think about it in general. There's other interpretations, but let's say there's been three big changes since the New Deal. One is the civil rights movement, which reintroduced race into American politics in new ways. Of course, it's always been central in American politics, but by sort of enfranchising Black voters in the South, Black voters joining the Democratic Party throughout the country, and then Democrats and Republicans nationally taking different stances on civil rights, that drew a lot of white voters out of the Democratic Party into the Republican Party. And that happened on a national level. It was happening locally before that. On a national level, it happened in 1964. So that's why I started my analysis in 1964, because that's sort of the first turning point in the breakdown of the New Deal coalition. And then we have the sort of rise of the religious right, which happened over several decades. I, in my mind, think about it as sort of like really consolidating in the early 2000s. But other people would put that, you know, there was a paper published in 1992. I think it was called The Year of the Evangelical. So people would put that timing at different places, but it was a slightly slower. It wasn't, you don't have this experience of kind of a critical turning point like we did with the racial realignment. So that's the second sort of breakdown in the New Deal coalition is religion. And then the third, which is happening alongside all of these things, is globalization, which leads to deindustrialization. And that is one of the causes, not the only cause, of a decline in unions, which is also exacerbated by sort of politics, often at the state level. So three things that sort of are hitting this New Deal, that the political and material realities of that New Deal coalition that I was interested in. And you can see it in these clusters. So I could immediately see two clusters of that, of those 467 counties, two groups that turned straight to the Republican Party starting in 1968. So immediately after the racial realignment, they've jumped ship from the Democrats, which is what, that's what we would expect based on the literature, right? Ringing
yeah,
a face.
Yeah. No, I'm thinking about that 68 election. And I don't want to hamstring your groove here, but I guess it's, I mean, wasn't, I mean, there's a lot of things going on. Obviously race was one of them, and civil rights, but also people were very, disillusioned by Vietnam. I mean, this was very mm-hmm. animating in 68, mm-hmm. also having Nixon, who was a former VP. He had run before in 60, you know, and people were just so fatigued with LBJ, predominantly for Vietnam, and how animating that was. How much of that is a kind of factor of pushing for that? And even, I'll just say, to make it more complicated, I mean, first term Nixon, you know, I think people have written about this, is probably not because he was a kind of, you know, warrior for things, but did have a lot of really fantastic bills passed, you know, Clean Water Act, and, you know, he had mm-hmm. EPA, and, you know, or maybe not EPA. It was, there's a variety of bills that he passed that we would now see as like pretty liberal by a broad definition. Mm-hmm. Obviously, second term Nixon is much different. So how much of that is, can we say, well, yes, there's a turn. 68 is an important year, but also, yeah. And race was huge. We had assassinations that year, unfortunately, many, many things going on socially. But isn't most of this people were turning because they were pretty anti-war at the time, and there was a draft and people didn't like that. Again, it was much different than kind of worse now. How do we factor that in here?
So I would think of those things as an election year fixed effect. So you can see, I think it's figure 2 or figure 3 of my book. You can see these different clusters. You can see their average Democratic presidential vote share over time. And you can see that they kind of bounce up and down in certain years, and they kind of bounce up and down together often. Mm. And that's because of the things you just described. So people responded to Obama positively across the country. There's an Obama bump mm-hmm. In most places, certainly not everywhere. But you know, places get an Obama bump. So Democrats got an Obama bump. They got a Reagan hit, right? Reagan was popular. So that's sort of a, like an election year fixed effect. It's kind of, you know, not constant everywhere, but you can see that in the ups and downs over time.
Okay.
But what I'm interested in is the overall trend. So when I say they jumped ship in 68, they jumped ship and they never looked back. So if this was a Nixon thing, mm-hmm. then they would have gone back for, you know, Ford, or they would have during Ford come back. They would have come back to the Democrats under Reagan, but they don't. They just keep going further and further Republican.
Sure. Okay.
And of course, the racial realignment isn't the only reason that this group of places went Republican and stayed Republican. And in the book, I also think these kinds of communities were probably influenced by the rise of the religious right as well. Mm. And so all three of these forces. Mm-hmm. But what was nice about this clustering analysis, I could just really see these different political trajectories, right? So I was really interested in contemporary variation. That's a legacy of historical change. And you can see that. You can just see it in figure 2. You can just see these places that were together And then they go apart. Mm. And they go apart on a timeline that roughly coheres to the sort of historical narrative we have of this time period. And so that's how I chose my counties. I took a county from within each of the clusters. Mm. That was interesting to me. So there was this one cluster that had turned to the right and sort of stayed in the right. This one cluster that was kind of like a swing cluster, as you described. They sort of hovered around the 50% mark until 2016. So they really hard swung to the right in 2016. And again, I don't think of that necessarily as a Trump effect, right? Mm-hmm. Like I think of that as the accumulation of all of these historical processes, but they kept going to the right in 2020. Mm-hmm. So they're not, it's not just a Trump effect. Like something is breaking in that year that's moving that group of counties. Mm. And then another very small group of counties that remains voting Democratic in presidential elections all the way through 2016. That's just 4% of those original 467. So this sort of original analysis kind of gave me a scope to think about, like, systematically, what does that historical change that everyone else has written so wonderfully about, what does that look like? And how can that help me choose cases that will shed light on the broader phenomenon? Mm.
So just a real quick note here. You talked about the move to the kind of the religious right. I had a lovely conversation with Lauren Shepherd. She's a historian. She wrote a great book called Resistance from the Right. I think that's right. And she talks about how this happened. She takes like 2 or 3 years, late 60s, early 70s, and how it got really started, how the right moved on campuses in response to the left, and then how that got exported further, or rather that it was boosted by many people that we see now in media and or in Congress on the right, and how that it was kind of an arm for many of these things. It's very fascinating book, and that history on that one kind of piece that you're describing there.
Yeah.
So I guess
historians write the best books.
She's great. She's great. I highly recommend. We had a nice conversation. She's lovely. I'm just curious. I mean, we don't have to spend time on this. You've mentioned it a few times, but why, I guess, the New Deal? Like, what is it about the New Deal coalition as like the origin or the starting point, right? Like, obviously, we had time in the 20s and we had time, you know, during Teddy Roosevelt, turn of the century. And I mean, obviously, you got to find a starting point. I understand that. But I guess why, when we talk about the New Deal coalition, I mean, I have an idea of why, but why do you think that's such a like huge coalition to start with, and then to just follow through? Like, why not, you know, folks from, you know, Teddy Roosevelt or maybe other other folks? Is it because it was for maybe the first time there was so many people of different backgrounds, of different places, of different socioeconomic class, whatever, that were together with a party and, you know, things like, I mean, they obviously had a lot of resistance as well, but why, what's so special, if you will, about the New Deal coalition? Why is that like the genesis or the origin point of then everything trying to see, you know, you even hear this when you hear people talk about like LBJ trying to maintain the New Deal coalition and he was a New Dealer. Like we hear this even into the 60s and 70s. Why that? Why is that the origins or starting point?
Yeah. So I think, you know, if we think about the US as a comparative case, which we all should and don't as much as we should. But if we think about it as a comparative case, like one of the big puzzles that's animated social scientists for a really long time is a quote unquote American exceptionalism. And there's a lot of different versions of that. But one version of that, one puzzling question is sort of like, you know, why doesn't the US have a welfare state that's as well developed as, you know, similar advanced industrialized economies? Or why did the US not develop as large a labor movement as similar advanced industrialized economies? Mm-hmm. Or why is US politics not divided along class lines as much as other advanced industrialized economies? So that's the kind of comparative
question,
right?
Because we're different. That's why we're different.
Right? Yes, no.
That's why.
Totally. And I'm not going to ever answer that question. But so that's a sort of comparative question. And that's the reference point, like other advanced industrialized economies, right? But there was a time when the US kind of moved a little bit in that direction. And that was the New Deal. And there's sort of this old literature in political science about political realignments. And that's kind of what I've just been talking about. And the sort of consensus of that literature is that there have been a couple periods in our history where the dominating cleavages, whether you think about cleavages as issues or social groups, that those have reoriented in the parties, right? So, you know, what the Democrats mean and what they represent is not fixed. It's not fixed in time. It changes over time. Similarly, what the Republicans mean, what they represent, it changes over time. And this literature would suggest that there have been a couple key turning points where that meaning has shifted so much that people actually, the people who vote for the Democrats are different now than what they were 10 years ago. Mm. And the issues that dominate politics are different now than they were 10 years ago. Mm. And so that happened. It's like pretty, I think, well accepted that the New Deal was a realigning moment, as was the civil rights era. Mm. You can see it in that figure I described. Mm. It wasn't just that one election, right? As I said, it kept going and going. So that's the full realignment. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a long-term shift in the meaning of the political parties and who affiliates with each party and why. And so that happened during the New Deal. The Democrats began, so the Democrats had, of course, historically been the party of slavery. Mm-hmm. And as you were talking about the progressives under Teddy Roosevelt, progressive politics were within the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. So there was no clear sort of like class cleavage in American politics until the 1930s and FDR. And that was also the time when we sort of started, you know, there wasn't the beginning of the welfare state. Other people have read about this, but sort of undoubtedly an unprecedented expansion of the federal government's intervention mm-hmm. in people's daily lives mm-hmm. during the New Deal. So it was this key moment of sort of like consolidation of something that looked like what people thought politics was about. But the social scientists were all a little bit Marxist as well, right? So like mm-hmm. they all thought like politics should be expressing sort of the fundamental cleavage of the industrial era, which is workers and capital. And so like when it finally emerged in the US, everyone was like, aha. Mm. And so it's sort of, I think, like widely accepted that we are very different from other advanced industrialized economies, as you said. But the time when we were like closest to that idea of like an organized struggle between the haves and the have nots was the New Deal. Mm. And because I'm interested in what happened, like why we aren't like that today, that was my broader interest. I thought, let's start from a time when we were like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I figured it was some version of that, but it's nice to hear you explain it. Because I think some people might say like, okay, we keep hearing about New Deal Coalition. Like that was almost 100 years ago. Why are we still talking about it? But it is a good, marking point. So we'll talk about place and all this stuff, but I want to ask just a kind of little bit on details of getting the information. So you talk about something called snowball sampling, which you can talk about. So I was curious about how you did a lot of interviews. Were these semi-structured, or more freeform? What types of ethnographic were you producing? Like, what was the kind of ways in which you talk about a little bit of some of the kind of field work, if you will, that you were doing? Mm-hmm. How did you gain or obtain the information to then write about it? How did that work?
Yeah, that's great. Okay, so let's see. The spine of the book, the spine of the argument, comes from repeated interviews with a sample of 86 people across the three field sites. So about 25 to 30 folks within each field site. And I started interviewing them in June of 2019. And so I spent about from June of 2019 to November 2019, kind of moving back and forth across the three places, interviewing people and doing some ethnographic observation, which I'll tell you about in a minute. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of round one. And I kind of wanted to talk to people. And this is also a moment of giving credit where credit is due. My advisor, Liz Clemens, was like, you need to talk to people a year before the 2024 election or 2020 election starts, because you need to know what they're concerned about before politicians tell them what they should be concerned about. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go and I'm going to do one round of interviews. So I did that. Mm. And then I also, while I was there, in addition to interviewing those 86, I call them residents. These are people who aren't formally involved in politics. I also interviewed people I call community leaders, or a lot of political scientists would call them sort of local opinion leaders. So these are elected officials, pastors, labor leaders, nonprofit heads, those kinds of folks. So people who are kind of actively involved in running these towns. And then my plan was to interview those 86 residents again during their primary in that state. And the states were Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Indiana. So I was going to go back to Minnesota and then Indiana and then Wisconsin in sort of the winter, spring of 2020. Mm. And then I was going to interview them once more right before the 2024 election. So September, October, 2024. Mm. And then in between, that summer of 2024, I was going to sort of just be hanging around with the county political parties. I had met people in the county political parties and kind of seeing what campaigning looked like on the ground in these places. But you might recall what happened in spring 2020, which was the COVID-19 pandemic. I was actually in Minnesota, in my Minnesota field site. I'd been there for about 3 weeks. And I remember I was in the YMCA one morning and, I was the youngest person in the YMCA by I was a third of the age, probably of the average age, right? Oh, maybe half, let's call it half. So I'm talking to this group of women and they're sort of talking about how they're going to be going to, what's the store? Costco. They're going to go to Costco and kind of stock up on food. Mm-hmm. And this was I want to say March 10th, mm-hmm. right after Super Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And they're going, and I've just met the caucuses in a room, two rooms full of people breathing on each other and hotly debating politics. And they're we're going to stock up on food. And I'm sorry, is this a real crisis? And so I drive home several hours back to Chicago where I lived at the time. And then everything shut down. Mm-hmm. And so I was, fortunate enough that I had already had this sample of 86 people who knew me. And were willing to speak to me again. So I just immediately switched to phone interviews with them for the rest of the interview cycle, some Skype interviews as well, but mainly phone. And I ended up adding an additional round. So I did that. I finished that second round in Wisconsin, Indiana in March and April of 2020. And then the states, it's crazy how fast politics moves, but it was this intense debate about states reopening, if you remember at that time.
Oh, I remember. Yes.
Yeah. And so states were suddenly reopening. And again, my advisor was like, you at least need to talk to him about the states reopening. Mm-hmm. Hopped back on the phone and talked to everybody again in April and May. And then I went back and talked to them all again in September and October as I'd originally planned. So that was sort of those repeated interviews with that group of residents is really the core of the book, the core of the analysis. And all of those interviews were semi-structured, in-depth interviews. So I had an interview guide and I largely followed the interview guide, but I also probed where probing was needed. I let people kind of take me down their rabbit holes if we needed to go down a rabbit hole, particularly during the early days of COVID. There was so much anxiety, so much stress. So I kind of let people live that out and we lived that out together in a way. And so that was the sort of core of the data. And because I was doing this longitudinal study, so these repeated observations on the same individuals, it was actually really great for trying to develop the argument. So my first set of interviews were all about an hour and a half each. So I ended up speaking, I had about an 80% retention rate from round one to round four. And the people who I spoke to four times, I talked to them for about 4.5 hours on average. So it's a really long time to talk to 80 people. So what was great about that is A, I got to know them very well and know their politics very well. I also got to see the things that really stayed the same for them over 18 months that were really like touchstones for them and the way they thought about politics. But I also, which I didn't really think about before I started this research, my first set of interviews, I was, you know, I was a second year grad student. I knew nothing. I know nothing now, to be clear, but I really knew nothing then. And so my interview guides were bad. And this is true of everyone's first interview guide when they start a new project. You don't know what you're supposed to be asking. Mm-hmm. And so it evolves a lot when you're in the field. Because you realize this question doesn't work. It doesn't make sense. People can't answer it. If someone can't answer your question, that's your fault, not theirs. And then when I came back from the field in November of 2019, I transcribed and qualitatively coded all of those transcripts. And so
that's a lot of work.
But what that gave me is a set of patterns that had emerged from these really open-ended conversations I was having about politics with people, really open-ended questions like, you know, one of my favorite questions was, if you could have a magic wand and change one thing about the country, what would it be? Like, what do you think you're going to get from that? But when I ask that question four times over 18 months and it's the same thing, I'm like, gosh, you're really concerned about economic inequality, you know? But so I saw these patterns emerging that were different across the three communities. And I could also see some patterns that indicated why there were differences across the three communities. So in my second, third, and fourth round interviews, I created much more tailored interview guides that could really probe into those patterns and really try to kind of assess, like, why is this going on? What's happening in these places and why are they so different? So that's sort of the core of the book. You didn't want me to talk that much. I'm so sorry.
No. That's wonderful. I love it. Yeah, it's great. I guess I'm a little bit curious here personally. I mean, what was the... You know, how I think you mentioned in the book, but what do you think with the impact of when you were doing all this as the, you know, principal investigator and all these things, how were you, you know, how much did you feel your own markers impacted or didn't? So gender, ethnicity, class, you're from a different place, you're not from, you know, how much of that, and was there any worries about external threats to validity and things like that? How much do you feel? Or you could just kind of talk kind of loosely about what that was like, or how you were received, or how, you know, eventually I think it probably settled, I'm assuming, but maybe not. How did it feel? And yeah, what was it for you like doing all that?
Yeah, I'm going to say something else and then I will answer your question. So first, I think every person who does field work experiences at one time or another, you just get overwhelmed by the generosity of the people who are making your research happen. So I stayed in the Indiana field site with a family for probably like 2 months in total, maybe a little less, for free. I mean, I just loved them. And the woman who was hosting me was the former chair of the Republican Party, and she was incredible. And then in my Minnesota field site, I also stayed for like 3 weeks for free the second time I went with a woman I just met like during field work the first time I had been there. And she was like, oh, I'd love to have you. I have a spare room. I'm not using it. Like, come hang out with me. And so... You know, and that's like huge amounts of generosity. Like, it's kind of inconceivable, that generosity, because I would never let someone stay at my house. Not even my mom. She actually just asked if she could stay with me for 3 weeks. And I said, no. But they, you know, so it's like an inconceivable amount of generosity. But then there's sort of the smaller generosity, which is still enormous, which is all of my research participants talking to me for 4.5 hours. It's a long time. So that's how I feel about them, which is like overwhelmed by the generosity. And I learned so much from people. So how they felt about me is your actual question though.
Well, both.
So I think, a couple of things. So, interviewers and ethnographers always think a lot about their positionality, because you kind of have to, right? And that's what you're asking me about, is how my social position, so like the locations I occupy and sort of racial, class, and gender hierarchies, how those shape the way other people see me and how they are answering my questions. and how that affects the data that I'm collecting.
Yeah.
Not just whether it's externally valid, but just what does that mean about the data I'm collecting, right? Mm-hmm. And so you can't ignore that when you're in the field, because people are kind of saying things to you all the time that are revealing how they think of you. And so in these particular field sites, I would say a couple things. So one, I think I just thought it was so strange. Firstly, like, that's the first thing. What are you doing here in our town studying us? Lots of people thought I was a journalist. I mean, of course, I would tell people that's not what I was. But it would often take like repeated times of telling people what I was doing to convey what was going on. I met some young people who I hung out with, who became friends, kind of. I met some older folks who thought of me as like an adoptive granddaughter. So there were different ways of making connection with people, right? Sort of the same way you do in any social interaction, you make connections and they think of you in that way. But in the actual interview setting, which is where this is probably the most relevant, I would say there are a couple of things that really matter. So one, which I can't remember if I talk about in my appendix or not, is my sexual orientation. So I'm straight. I'm now married to a man. And that probably, it probably would have made some people, it would have changed the nature of what people were probably willing to say to me if they thought that I was in a long-term relationship with this man at the time. And people would ask me about these kinds of things, sort of, you know, like some older gentlemen were like, you're of marrying age. Why aren't you married? Like same thing, you know, same things you get from your own family kind of stuff. And so I would explain why I have this boyfriend and whatever. And so all that is to say, I think sexual orientation made people feel comfortable talking to me about sort of their concerns about like the LGBTQ community broadly. And then, so that's one key component of it. The other component, of course, is my race. I'm also a white woman. And there were several instances where people kind of drew a connection and said, people like us, when they were explaining, moments of trying to explain a threat to people like us from people of other racial or even religious groups. There was one really funny moment when I was talking to this group of men and I was asking them as, you know, they were all participating in sort of a group conversation and they'd given their consent for me to audio record. And so we were doing this whole thing and I was trying to let them have their normal chit chat, but set some subjects out there. Like, what are you all worried about these days? You know? And so at one point the subject, they went from healthcare to immigration. This was summer 2019. Everyone was worried about healthcare and immigration. That was all I heard, no matter place or partisanship, healthcare and immigration. So this group of folks concerned about healthcare, we go to immigration. My last name is Ternello, as you know, and it has that double L. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes, you know, people have, you know, pronounced it Ternullo, which would suggest that I'm a Spanish speaker, maybe a Latino woman. And so this man next to me said, wait, before we go into this topic of immigration, what's your family background? We don't want to offend you. I was like, my last name's Italian.
Very funny. But they were thinking about it though, right? They were considerate of, okay, let's clean it up a bit so we don't offend someone at the very least.
Yeah. So people were, you know, so I could see, you can never know the counterfactual. I can't know what these folks would have said had I had a different sexual orientation or race. Mm-hmm. But my feeling is that those two things were quite key in letting me kind of just like fit in just enough that some of the sort of major concerns about their, like, they're just like broad concerns about politics and society that they could just kind of say them without personally offending me, and so that was really helpful. So then the major axis of difference. So those are the ways in which was similar to a lot of my interviewees is that I was white and straight And I also went to a Catholic high school. So I was raised Christian, which was also important in a lot of contexts. Mm-hmm. So then the thing that I'm different from them on, of course, is like the whole PhD of it all. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of actually the thing I get the most pushback on from reviewers in journal articles, is that they wonder why I would think people would be telling you the truth, particularly, there's this growing distrust of institutions, academic institutions, mm-hmm. there's polarization in that distrust. Mm-hmm. So it's often people on the right of the ideological spectrum who are more distrustful. And so I'm doing these interviews with people across the ideological spectrum. And I'm trying to convince reviewers that they're all telling me the truth. And they're like, well, this group must be lying because they hate you. Mm-hmm. So this is the only way I can really try to, one, there's the fact that I interviewed them 4 times over 18 months and they were all pretty consistent. There's things that changed. Those things tended to change because the national politics changed. So COVID happened.
Yeah.
That then became people's number one issue. Mm-hmm. That was what changed. Mm-hmm. Other things were really stable. So it's much easier to be stable with the truth than with a lie. Mm. And the second thing is, yes, I was different to people on this dimension. But I think that people appreciated. So sometimes people did assume that I must be on the left because I was getting a PhD. I let people ask me at the end of the interview. I said, I'm asking you to answer all these personal questions about your political views. You can ask me anything. Mm-hmm. And people rarely did. So I think they would, once or twice someone did, despite me offering. So I think in some ways people described it as a kind of political therapy where they could sort of tell me what they were worried about. And I didn't respond. I didn't yell at them. I didn't, mm-hmm. I just sort of sat there and listened for an hour and a half. And then I did it again and again. And I think that's what people liked about it. And so I think one of the reasons people didn't ask me about my politics more explicitly is because I think they were like, it's nice to just pretend mm-hmm. that this is just mm-hmm. like, I'm just not going to deal with that fact. And when people did address it, people made jokes about my PhD. What does it stand for? Like piled high dog shit or something? Piled whatever like that is, whatever that joke is. Yeah. I heard that a couple of times. Yeah. But my family members make that kind of joke mm-hmm. to me.
Mm-hmm. You came down from the ivory tower to be with the the common folk. That's what it was for them. But the thing is, it's like, that's also a kind of stereotype, right? It's like not everyone that has a PhD is like that. I mean, maybe some people are like that, but no, people have different backgrounds before they go into a PhD program, right? Some people are, poor or come from a working class family, or they're not all trust fund kids or whatever, that might be a nice kind of look for them of like, oh, this person did come and they did talk to us. And maybe all those elites aren't so bad, it's not quite that way. Right. This is like a lot of things.
Yeah. So anyhow, I hope that people have fond memories of me. I have fond memories of them. I'm still in touch with a few folks.
It's nice. That's very nice. So I want to ask the main, I would say, thesis in the book, or at least a very big dominant thesis, so we can punch right to the heart of it, because there's many other things from that I want to ask you about, is, we mentioned it earlier, is the instrumentality of place. And place, as you said, it's not how you necessarily started out, but that's where you kind of ended with sorts of how place was important. And you talk about place-based partisanship and diagnostic mm-hmm. frames and the narrative of community identity for many different people. I guess you can explain all of that, but I want to ask though is this place in time? So let me kind of mm-hmm. give an example here.
Yeah.
So is it the fact that, so you need to have people that live in a place, right?
Yep.
It's not the place itself necessarily, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So if I think of, my where I live has been, there's been an evolution over time because people come and people go. People die, mm-hmm. you know, people are born there, whatever. And there actually has been an evolution politically where, you know, in the county I live in Maryland. So, but I guess the question I have is that if you, if, just because somebody you could say, let's say is more right-leaning or, you know, the argument is, well, there was a New Deal coalition and some stayed left, you know, liberal, some stayed right. And then some are kind of a mix. I don't think you can say that it's obviously forever. So if you go to a place, mm-hmm. it doesn't necessarily mean that there's going to be different people that are there. So I guess the you can talk all about place, but I'm curious about time as well, because it's mm-hmm. over time and as events happen, maybe it's not the place. Is there a demographic shift? You know, maybe we're talking over a long period of time, but I guess how far does that argument go of, mm-hmm. you know, this kind of place-based partisanship? As you said earlier, and you can explain, it wasn't just, okay, one cycle or one presidential election. There was a trend line that goes. And obviously things become, you know, firmly ensconced within a kind of place where you can say, you know, these are, you know, red counties or blue counties, red cities, blue cities, all these things. But that's not necessarily permanent either. And I don't think that's what you're arguing for. Yeah. But yeah, tell us about the place-based partisanship, and maybe some aspects of time as well, and how that works.
You ask such great questions. So fun. you realize this is just like every academic's dream is just to talk to someone who has great detailed questions about their own research for an extended period of time. Like, it's actually so fun.
well, I think it's important. I think it's super important. You're very nice, but it's very important though to understand the essence of what these things are, because one of my fears is that people read something and they say, okay, I grabbed this, boom, here's my, you know, 6 bullet points on this. Okay. And I can just repeat that. And that's fine. But I think when you really try to understand some of the essence or the elements of how this is the case and what are maybe certain limitations to that, then you can have a more robust, nuanced understanding of it. So, you know, that's kind of the motivation here. So tell us, please.
Awesome. Yes. Okay. So place-based partisanship, it's just a term that I'm used to talk about the portion of your partisan attachment, the portion of your affiliation with a political party that comes from where you live. Mm-hmm. So broadly, we think people's partisan attachment, it often matches their parents' partisanship. And so there's a sort of like family connection. It sometimes changes over time. It's quite correlated with things like education. So there's sort of like a set of demographic variables, and then your parents' partisanship. Those are the things that like largely predict partisanship. And I'm adding place. I'm not adding place, actually. A bunch of scholars have recently been saying that actually place itself affects people's partisanship. Where they live affects their partisanship, especially if they live there, if they grow up there. Sort of the place in which you grew up can have big effects on your partisanship. My goal in the book is to show one way, one mechanism by which place can shape and sustain residents' partisan attachments amongst people who live there at that time, right? So I'll get into the time dimension in a second. And so the argument is really about local organizations. And, you know, local organizations aren't randomly distributed across the country. They exist in certain communities for a wide variety of reasons, often historical reasons, right? A combination of kind of like where immigrants from Europe, quote unquote, settled, and maybe, you know, where industry thrived, then that could lead to a different mix of churches and different kinds of unions in a community. And then state policies can make unionization more or less difficult over time. And so the argument is really about local organizations today as shaped by all of that historical process, right? That is place specific. It's shaped by regional and state level and local level changes that make it more or less likely that a community will have a certain set of organizations within it. And then those organizations today kind of shape the way that residents talk about their social problems. This is the diagnostic frames. And particularly because I'm studying these post-industrial communities, it shapes the way they kind of think about these social problems related to economic precarity and the way they identify appropriate political solutions. So in my Democratic community, they think about social problems as rooted in these broad systemic economic declines. And they think that, government intervention at sort of all levels, but particularly federal government intervention, would help redress these systemic declines to their benefit. And then these local organizations also shape what I call narratives of community identity, which are sort of how people define themselves and their communities and where they see themselves fitting into party politics. So in that Democratic community, they think of themselves as sort of like broadly amongst this group of folks who are struggling in that system that's sort of systemically unequal, and that the Democrats are the party that represents sort of, one 92-year-old woman said to me, "I remember the Democrats represent the man on the street." That's what my dad taught me during the New Deal. And that carried with her through her lifetime. So this community still thinks of the Democrats as the party of the have-nots, and they think of themselves, their community that way, right? This community has been disadvantaged by these structural economic shifts, and the Democratic Party will help represent them. And that's because they have this core of politically mobilized unions. Those didn't just emerge. It's not a random, distribution. Those have been around in this community since the 19th century. They waxed and they waned, and they were really affected by state policies in Wisconsin, but they've persisted. And that turns out to be really important.
So the question I have here, as you were talking about this, is it sounds like, now this might just be a terms thing or a definition thing, which is, I usually hate disagreements or conversations about definitions or how they're termed, but
no, but it's important.
It can be important. Yeah. Can we say through, so I'm still connecting place and time together a little bit.
Yeah.
If you have that happening with local organizations, right? So I'm thinking about certain small towns, they have, local organizations, it's a union, it's a church, it's in the YMCA, right, whatever it is. Could you conceptualize that as based on through time, their and their functionality and their impact as local institutions, so that they become so entrenched within the place that you see them now, or you conceptualize them more as a type of local institution, sort of like a micro way in which we see the kind of macro institutions, within the country. And you can obviously look at that globally. People do that in different ways globally as well. But is that an acceptable kind of conceptualization there? Or would you say that's something a little bit different?
No, I love that conceptualization, although I'm not sure what you mean by institution. So I hate to be more getting into the weeds of definitions here, but there is one way of thinking about institutions and why they persist over time that comes from a set of institutionalists, historical institutionalists, but sociologists as well, who think about, and this is also a way that some political scientists think about institutional reproduction over time. But the idea is that, so these local organizations, in this case, I'll just call them, they shape the way that cities solve problems, right? And this is also not a novel argument for me. This is an argument several other folks have been increasingly making, which is that local governments sort of rely on nonprofit organizations as well as businesses kind of get stuff done in their cities. That's pretty commonly known. And so if you have a different set of organizations, different set of businesses, a different set of institutional actors in the community, you're going to solve problems in different ways. You're also going to talk about problems in different ways. The way that community leaders talk about their community and they talk about their social problems are going to be different depending on the organizational partners that they have in that town, right? And that's one of the key cruxes of this argument. And so people see an issue come up. Let's take hunger, which is like a widespread issue in these three communities, right? So hunger. So if you are a community leader in my Indiana field site, which is the Republican field site, you see hunger and you don't think, oh, that's a sign that like the jobs aren't paying enough. You don't think that. You think, oh, our economy is doing great. We have loads of jobs. Instead, you think, oh, let me call the five pastors that I know with whom I had a weekly conference call during the pandemic. And I'll call them up and see what they can do about this growing hunger problem in the schools. So you go to the pastors because you have really well-resourced churches there. Not just a lot of churchgoers, but really high quality church members who donate time and volunteer a lot with the churches. Mm-hmm. The church leaders then say, oh yeah, we can do something about that. They meet monthly. They all know each other. So then they say, oh, we'll fix this. And the local newspaper does a front page spread on the local churches getting together to address hunger in the elementary school. And then the mayor puts a note about that on his Facebook page. Everyone who belongs to one of these five big churches hears about it on Sunday. They chit chat about it. A bunch of their friends volunteer. And so the community says, okay, so when we see hunger, we solve it through churches and nonprofits. And so hunger is something that we as a community can resolve. Like, we fix hunger. And so the next time they see a problem like hunger, they think, oh, that's one of those community challenges. Like, we can fix that. We take care of those kind, that whole set of issues. That's how we identify them. So we're going to call back on the churches. Mm. And so in the sort of institutional literature, the idea is that, like, your cognitive frame of reference for what this, the way you define this problem is shaped by how you've defined similar problems in the past, which is shaped by these organizations. But then that feeds into the reproduction of the organizations because you've just now called on the churches again. And so then the churches are going to call on all those volunteers and everybody wants to give more money to the churches because it goes to such a good cause. And it really did help the hunger in the elementary schools. Now, it might not have helped the hunger in the elementary schools, but everyone saw it helping the hunger in that they saw it. It was talked about. They volunteered. They had friends who volunteered. And so this sort of reproduction of those local organizations over time, it's not that it can never change. Of course it can change, but there's a sort of like stabilizing internal stability to it all because of this sort of, if we think about them as institutions, it's really hard to kind of enact institutional change because of these sort of path dependent relationships. Mm-hmm. Where I solve a problem based on what I knew. And then in solving the problem, I reproduce the set of things that leads me to define future problems in the same way. Mm. And so it becomes really difficult to disrupt from within. Mm. And so in that sense, I think about these things exactly as institutions, but in that sort of sense of mm-hmm. institutions, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And that's another way to get at your question about time. So it's not that these places are the same over time. They've experienced sort of huge changes over time, right? They're different in a lot of ways. But there are some like historical legacies, and there's sort of a growing literature on this as well, these historical legacies of places. And that literature is always kind of wondering, like, why are places so durably impacting people's politics? Like mm-hmm. immigration in the 1940s shapes voting in 2016. Why is that? Yeah. And what I'm saying is it's because these sort of local organizations or local institutions, however you want to think about it, they have this kind of staying power. Yeah. Power. They reproduce over time to some degree, and that's enough, even if they diminish in strength as unions have or diminish in strength as churches have, enough to differentiate across these places. And we can see it in the quantitative data too.
This is, you explained that very well. I also would conceptualize, in this case, churches as a kind of local institution, mm-hmm. and I think generally, but I think maybe it's a little bit different in certain parts of the country. Maybe that when you have people that have, let's say, local institutions that have through time built things, community relationships, they fix problems. When people, as well-intentioned as they may be, come from the outside and tell them how to do things or that they're doing it wrong or that they're, certain ways, I think that, that's going to piss people off. And right, I'm sympathetic to that. I'm sympathetic to that. There's a better way to do it that might take longer, but I think it's a better way. Long-term and also not fracturing things that have been built, because you have to respect, because what I would say is, maybe you talk about this sort of less, this might be a more abstract kind of idea, but you're building culture. And when you're building culture, 100%. Right? When you build culture through these things, you have to respect that people before and current and, you know, whatever. And so there's a, when you have local culture with local institutions, mm-hmm. that has to be, I think, respected and appreciated. And I think, when you kind of flatten out the idea of culture based on one or two or three demographic variables, it is a very sloppy way, well-intentioned or not, of trying to do the thing that you're trying to do. And you can do that. You just have to be a bit more, considerate of people that have built culture in a place and time. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's, I mean, there's more than one way to do things, obviously, as you describe in your three different cities. But I think generally, I think that that's, that's a true kind of liberal pluralism, you know, by definition. So I think that that's a way of trying to understand that. I have a question about unions, but I don't know if you want to add anything to that. So.
Oh, no, I think you're totally right. And that's really the argument that I'm making in the book is that when politicians speak in a way that resonates with these sort of local cultural frameworks, mm-hmm. That's sort of what draws people into that party. Mm-hmm. And so, I've had a couple conversations recently with journalists about sort of like, you know, quote unquote, Biden's economic problem. Like, why don't people credit Biden for what is ostensibly a good economy? And I find it such a bothersome like set of questions. I mean, it's obviously very politically important insofar as we think these consumer surveys are predictive in any way of the election outcome. But I feel I've said this sentence so many times in recent months, but you cannot argue with someone's lived experience.
Yeah.
That is their lived experience. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And in the book, I'm arguing that people make sense of their lived experience in part through where they live, the community of people they talk to, and the local organizations that structure those interactions and discussions, mm-hmm. right? That's part of what's one way in which they make sense of their lived experience. Mm-hmm. And you can't argue with that. That is a losing proposition. I think that's another way of thinking about what you've just said. Mm-hmm. And so you have to respect what people have, believe in the sense of they've lived it and the lessons they've drawn from what they've lived. Mm. And that has to be the starting point of any of these conversations about, and the reason, you know, whatever, yeah, has to be the starting point of any of these conversations. Mm-hmm. Like we can try to trick people into thinking that they're having a good time in the economy, but that seems really hard to me given that the economy doesn't work for most Americans. So,
yeah, I mean, people vote on feelings. And if it doesn't feel like it's working well for you or people you know, then they're not going to vote for it. It doesn't matter. You can show all the metrics and the data, and that's nice. And it's true. Yeah, the economy is stable. It's not terrible. It's moderately okay. But if it doesn't feel that way, it doesn't really matter. Okay, so unions, really quick, I do want to ask this, and maybe this is the last big topic we can land on here, is because it's obviously huge for much of these regions, and it's huge generally. Mm-hmm. You know, historically, there's an interesting, and I know there's a wide range of literature on unions in the United States and the history of it and all these things, and it's really important. And again, it's not a one size fits all. There's a kind of, you know, there's different types of unions, things like that, but you know, unions still are very present in what we would say the Midwest and in even other parts of kind of old industrial towns. I think of, you know, Baltimore has elements of that. Pittsburgh does. Mm-hmm. Cleveland does. So even out here in the Northeast-ish Mid-Atlantic. But yeah, also still more of a living force, if you will, in many of the what we call the Rust Belt states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana, Illinois. And so I'm curious about, you can tell me about unions generally and what their function is and how they play differently. But one question I'm really interested in is there's a heavy presence with unions and being interested in some element of kind of populism. So wealth inequality, things like that, income inequality. That we see in Michigan and we see in Wisconsin. But I've always wondered this. There seems to be, and I could be wrong, but similar proclivities in terms of demographics or maybe even religion. Maybe there's also people that also work in unions as well. But like when I look at like Indiana, that is politically very red. That is, Indiana and Illinois aren't wildly different. I don't think they're wildly different from, you know, Michigan and Wisconsin and even Minnesota. I mean, there's a lot of overlap here, but they just are. I've always wondered politically why they are pretty red politically. They've been that way for a while. But then you have a place like Michigan that, you know, will go blue, or, you know, it's a swing state, but it'll go blue. Wisconsin might, you know, go blue sometimes. Minnesota's been blue since the, you know, the 40s or 46 or 52, whatever it is. So yeah, maybe just tell us about the impact of unions and then why, you know, you can use it from the examples from the cities in your book, but, you know, I'm just pulling Indiana there for, as an example, but why is there this difference there?
Yeah. I mean, my book is the perfect answer for this question. Right. So another great question. A couple things. And I wish I could remember off the top of my head the name of this fantastic book by a sociologist about the history of unionization in Midwestern states and the history of state policy around unionization, public and private sector. It's so good. And I really relied heavily on it for the first chapter of my book. So I'll just hopefully refer people to that chapter and you'll see the book and it will all make sense why it's so good. So Indiana has far less private and public sector unionization today than Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, all of them. And part of that has to do with state policy. Part of it doesn't have to do with state policy. It's got to be something else. So what's fascinating about this book is Indiana was the first of the sort of industrialized northern states to pass a right to work law. And I think they did it in like 1959, but I could be wrong. This is also in my book from this other book. So, so they did it. They did it early. But then they pulled it back. So unions were kind of asleep at the wheel. They let this law get passed and they clawed it back. They undid it. And then it got re-implemented later. But so they've never had as favorable of a state policy context as Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. So Wisconsin was the first state in the country to pass a state law allowing for public sector workers to collectively bargain. And I think that was in, who knows? Clearly I can't remember. But in the 1960s, in late 1960s, that was in 1959. And so anyhow, so you have these state policies that have been either favorable or less favorable for unions over time. So the two kind of big areas of variation are right to work and then public sector collective bargaining rights. So obviously Scott Walker in 2010 sort of clawed back some of those rights for public sector workers with Act 10. And then he passed a right to work law after that. So state policies, to your point, can change over time, but all of those states have sort of affected the difficulty of organized labor to organize and how hard or easy it is for organized labor to organize. So there are fewer unions, and in a simply like, you know, descriptive way, there are fewer unions and there are fewer Democratic voters in those places. That is not the whole argument of my book. My book is not just about like add up the union members and then correlate that with Democratic vote share and you'll have a positive correlation because actually based on survey data from the American National Election Studies, by 2016, there was no longer sort of any gap between union and non-union workers in terms of their Democratic voting. So there's something else going on that unions are doing in my Democratic field site that's keeping them in the Democratic fold. So remember, only 4% of those counties are still voting Democratic today. So this is a real outlier case. Yeah. And the unions, they are doing more than just existing. They are existing. They did survive the political attacks on unions in Wisconsin under the Scott Walker administration. But they're mobilizing politically. They're still engaged in local politics, really local politics, mm-hmm. city council elections. And so four of the 10 city councilors during the time of my field work were also labor leaders. Two others, one the mayor and one other city councilor, had been elected with the endorsements of organized labor. And so, you know, being a union member there means something different than being a union member in my Minnesota field site, where, you know, the largest private sector union in that town has not really engaged in politics, as far as I can tell, since the 1930s. Mm. And that's me trying to piece together that historical record from interviews with the current president of that labor movement, the president prior to him, who took over in the 1980s, and then local newspaper archives. I can't see any. And so from 1980, at least to the present day, no local political activism from this group, right? Sometimes they did some phone banking or some canvassing, but only for state reps, who the statewide AFL-CIO would say, you should, you know, endorse this person and get your people not going to endorse for this state, not at the local level. And so this sort of really key thing is that organized labor in this union town is electing union people to citywide office, who are then defining the problems of the community as a lack of good jobs, something that's beyond anyone's individual control, and saying, like, this isn't the fault of immigrants that you are having a tough time. It's not the fault of people of color that this largely white community is having a tough time. It's the fault of this unequal economic system. And we need to focus on protecting unions, which they actually do at the city level as best they can, and protecting union jobs. And that's the kind of policy that's going to help our community. And then guess what party offers those kinds of policies? The Democrats, right? So the argument in the book is that that accomplishment, what's going on in my Wisconsin town, is really difficult in the 21st century because of deindustrialization and because of these political attacks on unions, right? And so you not only have to survive as a union, you have to still be able to win a vote in the shop, which union leaders will tell you is sort of pretty hard these days. Yeah. So you not only have to get the workers to agree to the union, you then have to get them to go out and knock on doors for city councilors. In, you know, in this case, they have off-cycle elections. So in April in Wisconsin, it's cold. Mm-hmm. No one wants to do that. As one of these labor leaders in that Wisconsin community told me, you know, his coworkers are working 8-9 hour days. They want to go home. They want to clean up. They don't want to be knocking on doors at 6 p.m. or going to a protest, which is where I first met them, at this protest at City Hall. They don't want to be doing that. But he has to remind them repeatedly that their job, their wages, are actually rooted in politics, that economic outcomes are a political proposition. And that's what's lost in, I think, a lot of unions, which some historians would say promote a kind of job consciousness rather than a class consciousness. So they say, we need to collectively, we need to get a good contract with our employer. We need to protect your healthcare. That's what we need to do. Whereas in this other place in Wisconsin, unions are saying, yeah, of course, we'll try to get you good healthcare, but we're also going to try to elect city councilors who will, you know, sign project labor agreements so that the new city council building will be built with union labor. We're going to give good contracts to the city workers, those kinds of things. And so they're actually gaining material benefits from this political engagement. And so it's super clear in this community. Not super clear. This is also tenuous, but like it is, there are people actively trying to make it clear that economic outcomes are rooted in political outcomes. And so therefore you've got to vote your job. And that's huge, right? But this is an outlier. It's 4%. Yeah. It's one of 4% of counties, right? And so really hard to maintain. And so in my Minnesota field site, there are still unions, but they're not doing this political piece, haven't been for a long time. And in my Indiana field site, there are some unions, a police union, a teachers union, but they actually sort of the largest private sector union in town. It's kind of a long story, but they were kind of voted out in the early 1970s and the labor movement sort of fizzled after that. The kind of the labor movement is, a lot of people have sort of documented its massive impacts for economic inequality in the US. And I think that one thing I'm trying to do in this book is describe not just the quantitative impacts of the decline of the labor movement on American politics, but thinking about more broadly, what does a political labor movement look like? What can it do? What are realistic prospects for growing the labor movement and helping it reengage in politics in a way that's not as exclusionary as it used to be, it's more inclusionary, and that has a sort of broader political scope for its members. And I think the city is not necessarily the only model, but it's also not that different from like some of these really radical working class mobilizations we had in the 1930s. At this, you know, time, you know, there were a lot of problems with unions in the 1930s. The AFL in particular was explicitly like anti-immigration and racially exclusionary and all these things. But there's a version of this kind of mobilization that I think is really powerful.
It reminds me when I had a conversation with Nelson Lichtenstein, who's kind of a labor historian, is how he calls himself. And we talked a lot about, he had a great book about the Clinton presidency, not very fond of it. That's not surprising. And what he talks about, you know, kind of at the bigger scale, but this, you know, it's not a biography about Clinton per se, although it kind of is, but it's also not just exclusively a history of labor. It's kind of both at the same time. But he talks about those interactions with that. It's very fascinating. You say somewhere in the book, it's towards the end, I can't remember, but you know, we've had a shift from all politics being local to all politics being partisan. So give me the 2-minute pitch here about why place-based partisanship is important for understanding cultural and political identities in the heartland of America today.
So I think the industrial heartland is politically important. The states that I'm studying and the states that this study is the most relevant to are electorally important. And the communities I'm studying are electorally important. So small, largely white, largely working class communities in a handful of states could determine this presidential election and several future presidential elections. So we really care. We really need to know about sort of how they got to where they are and where they might be going and what might tilt them one way or the other on that future trajectory. And I think we have some good explanations already in the literature about what's happened to this group of people and their communities and where they might go in the future. But I don't think that we fully understand kind of how people who are cross-pressured, by which I mean sort of both parties want them. Their social group membership, so being white and working class, like both parties are advocating for this group of people. We don't fully understand sort of the various factors that tilt people in that sort of tight intermediate position into one column or the other. And so place is one of those factors. And as I said, other research has shown that. And what this book is trying to do is show how it accomplishes that. So how is place functioning to tilt people, this sort of crucial electoral group? How is place helping tilt this crucial electoral group into one column or the other? And I hope that it gives a sort of broader historical perspective so we can see that like some places, some of this group of people in certain places, they're not really cross-pressured anymore, right? So in that Indiana case, like they really are just thoroughly with one party. In the Wisconsin case, they're thoroughly with another party. But in this case that's more recently turned to the right, we can really see sort of what would be the local institutions over the long term if we're thinking about kind of rebuilding sort of this coalition of voters or remaking it into a different coalition, maybe a sort of cross-racial working class coalition. What kind of institutions might bring that town into a cross-racial working class mobilization? And it's politically mobilized unions. That's my argument, right? And what do we need to do to kind of, if we're worried about that Wisconsin town, if we're worried about them leaving the Democratic coalition, what could people do to keep them in the Democratic coalition? Mm. And so those are, I hope, important questions that are relevant for American electoral outcomes. And they're, I think, also relevant for social scientists who, like I said, we think a lot about partisan identity as stemming from these key sort of social identities. Mm. But that's not 100% of the variation. So I'm adding a story about this other piece of variation and how that piece of variation place sort of shapes partisan attachment.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's wonderful. You explained that very well. Stephanie, we need more people like you. Of course, 90 minutes goes so fast. I could do it another 90 very easily. But I'll respect your time and I'm so grateful for all of your energy and for coming on and explaining all this. I found it, so fascinating, very illuminating. The book is fantastic. And so big thanks for coming on and giving us all of your wisdom.
Thanks for having me. As I said, talking about my research is like the best thing ever. And you really clearly read this book in greater detail than anyone else ever will. So I appreciate having this conversation with you.
Very kind. Absolutely. Thank you.